Hello and welcome to this podcast from Podularity. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this program is Serbian-born, London-based writer, poet and academic, Vesna Goldsworthy, whose books include a recent collection of poetry, The Angel of Salonika, and a memoir entitled Chernobyl Strawberries, which one reviewer described as suffused with a longing complicated and deepened by the eradication of the Yugoslav state. When I met Vesna at home recently, it was to discuss Inventing Ruritania, The Imperialism of the Imagination, another book which contemplates the identity of Southeastern Europe, in this case the construction of the Balkans in the British literary imaginary, a gently ridiculous proxy, as Vesna calls it, typified by the fictional kingdom of Ruritania, for the real Balkans, a repository for the qualities of a region which by turns attracted, fascinated and repelled the British, a place that could be turned into farce and pastiche, or depicted as a place of potential menace, where European identity dissolved into something irredeemably alien and Eastern. Goldsworthy's reading is wide-ranging, from Byron by way of The Prisoner of Zenda and Dracula to Olivia Manning's Balkan trilogy, Rebecca West and beyond. In his review of the first edition in the London Review of Books, Balkan expert Misha Glennie said, "It is thoroughly enjoyable and peppered with hilarious or hair-raising quotations from some of Britain's most admired authors." Originally published by Yale in 1998, Inventing Ruritania has just come out in a new, revised and updated paperback edition from Hearst. And towards the end of this interview, we reflect on how writing about the region has changed since the book first appeared. I began our interview, though, by asking Vesna what it was like returning to the book 15 years on to prepare this new edition.
The research actually dates back almost 25 years from the day I arrived in this country as a young postgraduate student. This was my primary field of interest, and it is quite understandable how the others see me as a person from the Balkans. I wanted to understand that. And actually, it was interesting to revisit it now at a distance of almost 35 years, if you add this kind of long reading tailback, because a lot has changed, but in fact, many of these Balkan stereotypes remain remarkably unchanged. The countries to which they are attached swap around. When I was writing the book itself throughout the 1990s, it was former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia. Now it's Bulgaria and Romania, or tomorrow maybe Greece, but you find the same lot of images trotting out. And so, actually, the updating needed remarkably little work, all in all.
I mean, you mentioned Bulgaria and Romania, and it's hard to turn on the radio or the TV or open a newspaper at the moment without seeing those countries as a source of anxiety in the British popular imagination, isn't it? And as you say, that source of anxiety has changed over the decades, but that southern eastern part of Europe has been pretty constant as generating that sense, or capable of generating that in the British imagination.
The diagnosis remains the same, if you want. It is as though Dracula is live and well, and at the moment he's running an employment agency somewhere in Bulgaria. And it is actually interesting that it is not necessarily the source of the fear, but the way that fear finds its expression, be it in popular culture or be it on television, in news programs, etc., is always articulated through the images I examine in Inventing Ruritania. And the expression is really this kind of sense of threat that you will be somehow swamped, infected, polluted by this area, which we now call European, but is always the other as well, the not quite European. There is always that residue of threat about the Balkans, which is remarkably persistent. And it actually starts from the moment when these nations, back in the middle of the 19th century, are about to join Europe, in inverted commas. So you have this kind of continuous trope of endlessly joining Europe, but never quite getting there.
I thought it was fascinating in the book that you mention many books which write about the Balkans have as their starting point this idea of the farewell to the familiar Europe, whether that's Venice or Vienna, that you're going into something which is alien and unknown and yet close. And I suppose both those aspects are really important. It's just over there, and yet it's no longer here.
It is actually interesting to map those points of departure. And why it is interesting is that normally, be the books the novels or travelogues, they start with this farewell to the known world, farewell to us. Now we are moving into something different. And in Kinglake's Eothen, the move, which starts on the banks of the Danube, literally involved going back 14 days because there was a calendar difference there, not just a time difference. But later on, Second World War, that sort of time, it was pretty much as it is today. You have Venice, you have Munich, you have Vienna. This is the last point where you see us, Europe, and now you're moving into the Wild East. The Wild East, however, is interesting because it is a movable feast, to use Hemingway's term. It is always southeast from wherever you are. So Prince Metternich said that the Balkans begin on the Landstrasse, which is the road out of Vienna towards the Balkans. But if you talk to the Croats, the Balkans begin on the Bosnian border. If you talk to the Serbs, the Balkans begin on the Albanian or Kosovo border. And the idea is, and this is why I think the Balkan stereotypes are so insidious and so persistent, is that they have actually in some ways also been adopted in the Balkans themselves as a kind of stick to hit those who are more primitive than you. So if I say, am I Balkan? What I'm asking is, am I primitive or am I civilized and ready to join the civilized world?
Yeah, I was translating an article recently about Slovenia, and it was talking about how very keen Slovenia is to dissociate itself from that Balkan identity, and so therefore, for Slovenians, Balkans are very definitely things where, you know, they're looking to Austria and Italy, but the Balkans are the other countries which are further east and further south.
Absolutely, and it is actually, for me, this is now funny, but in the 1990s, it was absolutely painful because I hailed from that area, that actually, when the Western intervention was sought, each one of these nations offered itself as a kind of bulwark, you know, take us, befriend us, and we will protect you from the Balkans. So we are the kind of, what even in kind of the days of Roman Empire was a kind of ante murale Christianitatis, the beginning of Christendom. And each nation saw itself right there.
And Greece, of course, has also sought to carve out a particular identity and path for itself, again, sort of repudiating any kind of identification with the other nations around it.
It is actually interesting that a lot of my Greek friends, and now we're going back two decades, when I started planning and mapping the research, would say, you're not including Greece, are you? And the idea was that Greece isn't Balkan. But in fact, one of the Greek foreign ministers said at one point that there are two Greeces, the Balkan Greece and the Mediterranean Greece. And the Greeks, because they are the kind of cradle of European civilization, I'm speaking in inverted commas here, see themselves, or have tended to see themselves, very much as the Mediterranean heartland, the Mediterranean cradle of European culture. However, the moment they misbehave, the Balkan stick comes out. And you will have noticed that with the Euro crisis, et cetera, that suddenly Greece, which was the first Balkan country to join Europe, has been sort of unceremoniously pushed in the Balkans. And all the stereotypes that you find examined in Ruritania, you know, of those kinds of primitive, corrupt, lazy Orientals, have suddenly been kind of planted right back there, down around Athens.
That spatial journey that we were talking about, you know, going from the familiar Europe into something unfamiliar, is not just spatial, it's also sort of temporal, isn't it? When Jonathan Harker in Dracula is going east, you have a sense of, or his sense of, the railway timetables breaking down, the sense of time becoming different, which of course in the Western imagination has been part of the way that the Orient has been figured, isn't it? So there's a sense of this as a sort of liminal space between familiar Western Europe and the Orient and all that stands for.
These metaphors are actually fascinating because obviously the temporal difference was concrete, and talking about Jonathan Harker, it is actually the train timetables that imposed and created our notion of time in Britain as well as in the East. And so now he travels by train and the trains get delayed, etc., etc. And suddenly he's crossing somewhere where time doesn't matter as much. I remember in one of those books reading and never actually finding out whether that was true, that the shortest unit of time in the Ottoman Empire apparently was something called dakika, which was 12 minutes. So suddenly you are in these places where two units of 12 minutes is about kind of the fastest you can get your drink delivered to your table. And it is actually very funny, because at the same time, even the most kind of well-inclined writers see the Balkans. I think it was Edith Durham who said that they are the Rip Van Winkles of Europe, that they kind of fell asleep in the Middle Ages under this kind of duvet of the Ottoman Empire and then awoke in the 19th century. And so you are going back in time, both in terms of these kind of hour, 2-3 hours difference, but in terms of centuries too. They're desperate to catch up. However, when we talk about this, the movable feasts of the Balkans, an omnipresent thing in British literature is that Europe as a whole is a bit like that. So whatever you attribute to the Balkans, by extension, you can somehow attribute to Brussels too. You know, this kind of dark, corrupt Byzantine space. So sometimes it looks as though you're kind of stepping into the Balkans the moment you cross the English Channel. What it proves is the kind of power of the metaphor.
It was interesting, I think you said, when German and Italian unification had come about, they were less quaint. They didn't have all these little princelings. And so there's a sort of shift east for that kind of exotic form of European difference.
Well, it is actually fascinating. I had this kind of trouble trying to think of an ideal title for my book. And because there are two parallel types of stereotypes about the Balkans. One is this Gothic, threatening Dracula myth. But Transylvania, believe it or not, and many British people don't, is a really existing place. However, Ruritania was this imaginary and actually rather benign Germanic principality. And when Anthony Hope wrote Ruritania, he set it somewhere 2 hours south of Dresden as you ride a horse. I don't know how fast you can ride, but you don't get much further than the borders of Czechoslovakia. So it was originally somewhere there. By the time the film industry took over the myth, and this book is now principally remembered through many film versions, the maps have shifted because Germany became threatening, and also it became too well known to house anything imaginary. Even now, when you think about the Balkans, all these places like Herzegovina, Slovenia, Slavonia, etc., are muddled enough in people's heads, so it is still the place which can receive another imaginary statelet. And that coincides with the time when a lot of these redundant Germanic princes are then invited to take up the throne of Balkan countries. So it's a kind of real and imaginary interplay. I have a feeling that the English in particular were also a bit jealous that they were never invited themselves to run a Balkan country. Hence, you see the pleasure with which they wrote about Queen Marie of Romania, who was Queen Victoria's granddaughter, or in some ways, although obviously the context is completely different, about Paddy Ashdown, once he took the principality of Bosnia a few years back. So the kind of liberals ran a Balkan country finally, so many decades after Gladstone.
And it's clear that many of the British writers were completely untroubled by research or historical accuracy or ethnographic verisimilitude or anything like that. It was literally a blank canvas onto which they could project their fantasies, wasn't it?
It is, and it is actually absolutely important to remember when reading about these books or the books themselves, that actually the amount of research and the degree of knowledge about the Balkans are never simply assumed. Bram Stoker for his imaginary creation, did very detailed research. So his timetables are correct. You go to hotels and restaurants. Jonathan Harker stays in places which really exist. You could visit Transylvania and use it as a guide, provided you don't believe in vampires. On the other hand, you have someone like Agatha Christie, who actually went through a number of times because her husband was stationed in Iraq, and she names drops these really mundane places. Vinkovci, which is the setting of the murder of the Orient Express, is the equivalent of Slough, and yet creates a kind of dark romance around it. So the name itself, just name check, becomes this kind of moment of some kind of spurious authenticity. And they were not really even troubled by whether these things were true or not, because the writers wrote for entertainment. It was kind of the subsequent use and the sheer power and mass of that literature that becomes pernicious in a way.
Tell me about the pernicious aspect of it, Vesna. I mean, what do you really think is at stake? Because I think there's more clearly at stake than simply being a book about curious literature, you know, some of it forgotten, some of it still read. What do you think is actually operating between the literature and the reality?
What actually happens is that the books are absolutely wonderful and I really enjoyed reading them. Yet, the moment I started writing and examining their power, the politics kept coming between me and that enjoyment. And the political stakes are very high. How do you imagine an area? How do you draw a mind map? It creates a kind of, it has a direct impact on the sense of entitlement, the license to get involved, the desire to give visas or not give visas. I very often use the example of Romania because I've actually acted at one point as an advisor on what to do with Dracula through a sort of series of symposia organized by the Romanian government. And, you know, this seems like a silly thing, but what do you do there with Dracula? Do you create amusement parks? Do you dress your actors to play Dracula? Do you bend, cave in and make money? Or do you keep saying, no, this is nothing to do with any historical truth and just ignore it? You can't ignore it because people will come anyway. By the same token, the way the Croats or the Serbs or the Bosnians imagine the British may be interesting to an academic, but actually has no impact because the Serbs and the Croats and the Bosnians are not about to send the planes and the army to kind of help you draw the maps here, you know. So it's a sort of that when the imagination is accompanied by power, then you have to listen to the way that power talks and thinks.
Yeah, I mean, you make an instructive point in the book, I think, when you said it's not the same as Thomas Hardy's Wessex. It's not the same as deciding whether to have a theme park based around that and Dracula, because it's an imposition, really, of one culture's imagination upon another.
Absolutely. And Thomas Hardy's, I mean, I'm sure that Wessex creates a problem or two to a particular village west of London.
It's probably a traffic problem.
That's right, traffic problem. And you know, whether to build a tea house here or in the next place. And I can even imagine mini wars somewhere in you know, down kind of along the M4. But the problem with Balkans is that it actually does come to with this kind of enormous power. Do you permit entry? When do you allow country X to join the EU? If you allow that country to join the EU, on which terms? Go back 10 years and you actually have an even more basic question, rudimentary, which is, do you allow country X to exist? If you then think through the power of these images which are there with many British and American people, even from their early childhood. You know, my son here, who is kind of for all intents and purposes little English boy, had known about Dracula before he even realized it was the Balkans we're talking about, through Halloween and films, etc., etc. Then you actually see how enormous that power is and how important it is not to discourage the reading, but to help the understanding.
And with the economic situation, particularly in southern Europe, these questions are clearly of much more than academic interest, aren't they? The way in which sovereign states are losing control over their own destinies.
It is absolutely fascinating. Ruritania has had, my book, has had this afterlife, which often took even me by surprise in that sort of sense, that I mentioned that I suddenly got involved in political consultancy of a kind that few English professors ever have to trouble themselves with. The book gets quoted in TV programs and newspaper columns, etc., etc., because it isn't outdated in any way. It is continually relevant. And as I said, this kind of big searchlight kind of swoops from one place in the Balkans to another, from one trouble spot to another, but it is always then the same shorthand that gets imposed on it.
One interesting development since you wrote the original edition of the book, though, is the emergence of a generation of diaspora writers, writers who've come from the Balkans, but are now writing in English and finding an Anglophone readership. And of course, you make the point that leads to the question of how they represent the region from which they have come to the community of readers that they are writing for, and the dangers of what you call self-exoticization.
It is a fascinating question, and one that had actually troubled me too, because I, in part, although I'm slightly older than this young generation of predominantly refugees of the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, who are Western educated and now writing. But where it's troubled myself is that I wrote what became a best-selling memoir, and it was serialized on Radio 4 and in the Times. And when I was writing the story of my life originally just for my son. Eventually, it became a book. But I was acutely aware of the kind of pull of the market, which is towards that exotic thing, and the kind of ranks of booksellers waiting for me to deliver that, and the kind of pull of a certain sense of a refusal to self-exoticize in that way. On the other hand, the moment you start writing about the Balkans, you also become aware of how, this is what I mentioned in relation to Agatha Christie, it's almost impossible to fight just the sound, the resonance of some of those names. So by the time I say Balkan, by the time I say Transylvania, by the time I say Ruritania, my predecessors in that writing become Christie, Stoker, etc., rather than all the Serbian writers that I grew up with. So you're kind of really fighting against this huge kind of avalanche of tradition. However, the optimistic thing is that many of these diasporic writers sort of employ this very strategically, and they play with stereotypes, but very, very gently subvert them, so that by the end of these new books, you also laugh a bit and realize that you're laughing at yourself too. And so I'm, in a way, sometimes I say this self-exoticization is kind of defeating the object, but at other times I'm very optimistic about what happens now.
I was talking to Vesna Goldsworthy about the new edition of her book, Imagining Ruritania, The Imperialism of the Imagination, which was recently published in paperback by Hearst. You can find out more about it on their website at www.hearstpublishers.com. And you can find many more podcasts on a wide variety of subjects at podularity.com, or by subscribing using iTunes by typing Podularity in the search box. Until next time, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.